welcome to On the Brink Radio. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson coming at you from the shores of the Anatoki River here in the edge of Kaharangi National Park on the South Island of New Zealand to Waipunamu. It's Friday, the 25th of January. I'm sitting here by this beautiful river, sound of the cicadas. I'm staying for a few days at a community called the Rainbow Valley that's existed here since the early 1970s. And I've heard of it for a few years, and I just decided to come and check it out for a while. They have accommodation. I've got a little simple cabin that's actually quite nice, but it's a very special place because not only because all the people that I've met so far are all extremely nice, but the main thing that just jumps out at me is that it's extraordinarily quiet in the sense of there's almost no human noise that I hear. I've only heard one plane all day today, and it's already like 4 p.m. Heard one tractor going in the distance. I've heard zero lawnmowers, zero whippersnippers, zero helicopters, zero quads. I haven't heard any cars zooming by. I haven't heard any people yelling or talking. It's just an extraordinarily beautiful gift to be here for no other reason other than just the bioacoustic tranquility. And that's such a huge issue that, you know, even as sensitive to noise as I am, I still find that if I'm in an area with lots of noise, like where I was just in Christchurch for a week, or even just house-sitting for my friend on the edge of Takaka, you kind of like, I can't say that I totally get used to it, because I still hear, I consciously notice and hear every loud intrusive sound. And it may or may not annoy me, although it's likely that it will, but I'm not going to freak out about it, because, you know, I'm not going to say there are things that can be done, but you don't want to just tune out obnoxious stimuli, because then you become desensitized to it, and then it doesn't matter ultimately if you notice it or not, because if it's there, it's affecting you and other people and other life forms too, either consciously or unconsciously, through the perception of the noise or the noxious smell or the electromagnetic energy or whatever it is. It's, even if you're not noticing it or pretending like it's not there, it's still there affecting you. So in a beautiful place like this that's been, especially since Lisbon and I haven't been together for the past 5 years, I haven't spent nearly as much time in remote areas like this as she and I used to do, which was very special. We were able to live for weeks or even months at a time at places like our friend Arnie's place on Flinders Island with no electricity at all, on Great Barrier Island with minimal electricity, but it's becoming increasingly developed there. But I guess also part of that is because I've taken on a lot more work. For example, my On the Brink radio show, of which this is broadcast number 263, I believe. So that alone means that I sort of need to be not out of touch with the external world for more than a week. But I don't mind, and I really like to thank, again, my beautiful friend who I hope to meet someday in person, Jewel Stanley at UCY-TV, for her many years of dedicated broadband full-spectrum warfare on ignorance and stupidity in the form of hosting quite a few dozen investigative radio shows, of which mine is one. I've been doing it since December of 2012. Anyway, Rainbow Valley, Google it. You can find some really cool information. It's a beautiful place. My little cabin is just almost right beneath a huge, beautiful apple tree that's just now putting out some beautiful, beautiful apples. And I picked a few that fell on the ground but before they had started to rot. So that way you know they're really ripe. But really lucky that apples are just now coming in. They've got beautiful gardens. It kind of reminds me, just in my mind, of what this formerly legendary place in Scotland called Fintorn. Rainbow Valley is probably kind of like maybe what Findhorn might have been like back in the day before it became a new age community where they were charging people a lot of money in order to come there and work, doing all their workshops and their publishing and all this stuff. And I do feel, when I was at Findhorn in 1998, I did feel a genuine sort of nature vibe there, and all the people were quite cool, but there was also a lot about it that I didn't really buy into. It was kind of like a cult where all the people there would go and meet early in the morning in order to meditate together, and I never took that up. And so after about a week, I didn't really fall out of favor with them, but they saw that I wasn't really going to become one of them. Not that they thought that to begin with, but the topic of today's show, and there's many shows that I'm going to be doing that are all of equally profound significance, and a few that are sort of icing on the cake of maybe not dealing with on-the-brink issues per se, as I tend to do, but, for example, a show coming up that I might be able to record in the coming week with a brilliant musician, primarily a flute player named Peter Phippen. That's P-H-I-P-P-E-N. He lives in Wisconsin. And we've been in touch for a few years. I first heard some of his music, which I really liked. And he's very knowledgeable about music and the psychology and esoteric dimensions of music and sound and bioacoustics, as well as music. And so this show will be an interview with him and a discussion about a lot of this stuff. And then also I'll play some of his music, maybe even get him to play some live flute when I record the Skype session. Anyway, today's show is in honor of where I am, New Zealand, or Nueva Zelandia, as named by Abel Tasman. The South Island, its Maori name is Te Wai Punamu. It means the waters of the greenstone, the sacred nephrite jade that is so important to the Waitaha and the Maori people. I might actually be looking at some in this river right now, unbeknownst to my eye, to be able to recognize it. The North Island is called Te Iki a Maui, which is the fish hook that Maui, the legendary adventurer and ancestor, it's either the fish hook or the fish that he pulled up when he was fishing. And then you've got Stewart Island, whose Maori name is Rakiura. You've got Aotea, which is my very, very, very favorite place in New Zealand, Great Barrier Island, my closest I have to a home. And I'd really like to thank my friends John and Peggy and Garlic for their limitless friendship and hospitality and support and just being the coolest people I know. We're fighting the good fight there on several fronts. And then also Tahuru Otoe, which is Little Barrier Island, that I hope to visit someday. These are the five main islands of which New Zealand consists. Today's show is called Aotearoa Today. Not quite 100%. Aotearoa being the Maori name for New Zealand, that one of its translations is Land of the Long White Cloud. Not quite 100%. So if you're not quite 100%, it means like you're not fully there, you're not fully functional, that some things aren't exactly right, you're not at 100% health, you're not at 100% of mentality, 100% vitality. And it's kind of a takeoff on New Zealand's mantra that's marketed all over the world to the tune of who knows how many tens of millions of dollars they spend a year marketing this ideology, this meme. Which, if it were actually real, really true, you wouldn't need to say it. But you've heard it ad nauseum. 100% clean and green, New Zealand. 100% clean and green. It is not the case at all. It's not even remotely the case. I mean, a lot of New Zealand, much of the year, is very, very, very green. Extraordinarily green. As green as Ireland. I've seen many, 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 many different shades of green in one view. Especially during the rainy seasons of the year that could not be matched by Ireland or any other sort of place that's known for its luxuriant verdancy. But New Zealand has a lot of major issues affecting her right now. And I love New Zealand. If I didn't love her and the people and the land and all the flora and fauna, there's no way that I would ever be aware of all this stuff, but because I've spent many years out of the past, since Valentine's Day, February 14th, 2000, when I first arrived in New Zealand, I've spent a few months of every year here in constant motion all around both islands, getting to know many cool people, many cool places, visiting my favorite places and seeing how they've changed different times of year, and also visiting new places. Like, for example, last year I got to visit the Gisborne East Cape area, which was really, really fantastic, the first time I've ever been there. And I'm going to go back probably in late February and visit Lake Waikaremoana. So that's a whole region of New Zealand I've never visited. But what I'm mainly talking about on this show today is what I consider to be the 10 greatest issues affecting the health of New Zealand's plant and animal life, including people. And I'm going to list them in reverse order of their significance. So I'm going to start, and again, this is almost an arbitrary listing because they're basically pretty equal, but in their degree of destructiveness and pervasiveness and ubiquity across the full spectrum of Aotearoa. But I had to put them, I can't say them all at the same time. So I'm going to start with number 10. Number 10 is the mining industry, of which Australia is just being literally eaten alive. It's probably got the greatest amount of mining of any country in the whole world in terms of the number of countries, the number of mine sites, the amount of different resources that are being extracted annually. New Zealand is quickly becoming like a small version of Australia. It's traditionally been known to have lots of valuable mineral resources, in particular gold, on the North and the South Island, but their traditionally conservative environmental policy for decades, from administration to administration, has been essentially to leave all the stuff in the ground, and not even necessarily for future generations, but just because the mentality of the past was that everybody has plenty to live on here. You know, why rape Mother Earth even more for something that's really done out of nothing but greed? Well, the professor of greed himself came along in the form of John Key, and one of the big legacies of his administration is that many mining companies from all over the world have now been invited and have already set up shop all around different parts of New Zealand. There's a lot of gold mining that used to happen along the west coast of the South Island, and even not that far from where I sit right now, near the edge of Kahurangi National Park here in Golden Bay. But mining is exploding all over New Zealand, and especially I think what's going to happen here is that you're going to see a lot of deep seabed mining, which is the specter that's going to explode all over the floor of the ocean, all over the whole planet, of using these robotic technologies to extract polymetallic sulfides, manganese nodules. A lot of this stuff is associated with hydrothermal volcanic vents on the ocean floor, but it's extraordinarily destructive, putting out plumes of liquid dust that'll just suffocate anything that lives down in there. And for the past decade or so, Papua New Guinea has been the target of the first attempt at deep seabed mining by a renegade Canadian company called Nautilus. But that's basically had its ass to drop out. And so now, when I was just in Rarotonga a couple of months ago, there, on the exact time I was there, the Prime Minister and the Resource Finance Minister were going around trying to convince the people on all the outlying islands that the deep seabed mining, which is now targeting the Cook Islands as its new place to set up shop, specifically two companies called DEME, D-E-M-E, which is a Belgian consortium, and Ocean Minerals, which is headed up by an American guy. So New Zealand has the fifth largest exclusive economic zone in the world, even though it's a relatively small country. It's got the fifth largest exclusive economic zone in the world. Now, actually, it may not be inaccurate for me to say refer to New Zealand as a company, so I'm not going to edit that out of the show. New Zealand is probably a company as well as a country. It's also, while we're on that topic, it's probably not much of a stretch to say that New Zealand could qualify as being the 52nd state of America after Australia being the 51st because of the American presence here in many, many, many different ways, and the same corporations, the same mentality, American military coming here. Anyway, but the deep seabed mining, like for example, New Zealand's doing all kind of tricky stuff like declaring a Kermadec ocean sanctuary up sort of in the northern end of their exclusive economic zone. But I think that if you read the fine print, all this does is going to keep out, for example, recreational fishermen and stuff like that. But anything that's where people are making money out of it, whether it's fishing, mining, deep sea bed mining, I think all this is going to be allowed to happen in this area, which is really the nature of what monuments and sanctuaries and reserves really are. It keeps out more visible stuff that's of little consequence, but it allows anything of quote-unquote national security or of interest to resource extraction interests. It allows all that to happen. Now, I listed as number 9 the whole climate change thing, not so much because that climate change, as is popularly portrayed, I consider to be real. I don't. Climate change is real. If you've got a climate, you'll have climate change, but over long periods of time. So what we're experiencing, A, we don't really know what's normal. And the atmosphere and the weather hasn't been doing anything that's not within the theoretical limits of what the weather actually does. Like, for example, we haven't seen concrete cinder blocks falling from the sky. We haven't seen whirling vortices of hydrocarbons. We haven't seen bolts of ice coming from the sky. Or we haven't, in other words, we haven't seen science fiction movie stuff. Yet we are. But climate change is popularly portrayed is clearly an ideology that's been marketed by the highest levels of those who market ideologies. We can name some names. We'll do that on a different show. You might look to a researcher named Peter Kirby, K-I-R-B-Y, and his hypothesis, the New Manhattan Project, for a lot of up-to-date information about this whole scenario. But New Zealand, the people here are literally eaten up with believing in the climate change ideology, just like they are in Tasmania. And people look at the supposed weird weather, which I think that I personally have experienced a lot of bizarre weather in just the past 3 or 4 years here on both islands. In fact, 3 years ago, I was actually glad to be leaving New Zealand. For the first time ever, I was actually glad to get out of the country because everywhere I'd gone, the weather was just absolute shit. It was just crap everywhere, bizarre and extremely windy and everything cold and just like inhospitable at totally unseasonal times and just far beyond the call of any kind of natural variations. So that's, again, it ties in with the whole concept of weather warfare, geophysical warfare, environmental modification. The people behind this know part of the whole thing is for it to not be so different that people wouldn't think that it's actually not Mother Earth doing it. So it's maintained within limits of believability. But it's like the atmosphere and the weather divas and the winds and the rains and the ocean currents and the jet stream. It's all, they're being tormented. It's like they've had Frankenstein electrodes injected to them in every possible way, chemically, electromagnetically. So it's like making their legs twitch electrically. It's making the wind do bizarre things it wouldn't normally do, or the lightning, like all the dry lightning strikes in Tasmania. thousands of them over like 36 hours. And when you see the pattern, they were in straight lines. I mean, does nature work that way? Everybody's, oh, nature can use straight lines. And I go, yeah, but it's like some people are so dedicated to not entertaining the possibility that geophysical warfare exists that they'll concoct any possible rationalization. And then, you know, if you claim not to believe in the mainstream climate change thing, then you're branded as a denier. Oh, the evil denier. You don't care about Mother Earth because you don't swallow the mainstream climate change ideology. And I go, well, look, read my satire about Elon Musk buying the entire U.S. military for $600 trillion, and he's going to use it to wage war on climate change by eliminating the atmosphere of the Earth, because if there's no atmosphere, climate change has no theater of operation from which to attack us with its evil love of the deadly toxin carbon dioxide. New Zealand even has, I believe they might be the only country in the world to have a zero carbon policy instituted by their talking horse Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern, who I think would actually, you'd probably be better off listening to Mr. Ed. You'd be better off listening to Mr. Ed, the talking horse, than her. Zero carbon. Zero carbon means zero life. Plain and simple. Okay, number 8, moving up the list. We've got the extremely out-of-control tourism industry here, which I've seen metastasize like a tumor ever since I first came here. The first thing I was really exposed to was seeing all the film crews around both islands for Lord of the Rings. And I go, oh, that's cool. They're making a movie about the Tolkien books. But what it really was, I think by design all along, was it was basically an advert for the tourism industry to draw people to come to New Zealand as tourists that are willing to pay lots of money to come here and be exploited like just like dairy cows. And interestingly, Australia followed New Zealand's lead in creating a film called Australia, if you can imagine that, a film called Australia, as if I don't think there'd been one before. Just Australia with Nicole Kidman and Hugh Jackman. And it was the story of a station owner. But anyway, that film, even though the second time I saw it, I kind of liked it from the perspective of the young Aboriginal boy who was really the star. I kind of liked it all right, but it was bogus because it was filmed a lot of these different places, but none of them were where it claimed that it was. But this whole project came about because the government of Australia and Tourism Australia teamed up together and they go like, look, we want to produce a film that will do for Australia what Lord of the Rings did for New Zealand. And it didn't quite work out that way. And praise the Lord that it didn't, because what it's done for New Zealand, that and their other nefarious propaganda techniques that are so, with so much money behind it, to convince the world to come to New Zealand. I mean, I remember when I was here, the first few years I was here, they were saying stuff like, you know, so many people are going to want to come to New Zealand. They're going to want to move here. We're going to have to put up military to guard the borders to keep all the people out, like boats of refugees and you know, hordes of cruise liners without passport. They want to come and just land and come and live here because it's such a cool place and it's free. It's free from all the evil stuff in the world. Such has not happened. In fact, I think, I may be wrong, but I think the population of New Zealand might actually be declining, except for if you want to count Chinese. And so the influx of Chinese is unbelievable, and that's another issue in itself. Well, I may as well talk about it now. I have no problem with Chinese people. I have Chinese friends, but there's so many of them here in New Zealand and in Australia, especially Tasmania. I mean, maybe, you know, I can't speak about places that I don't go, but I go all over New Zealand, all over Australia, all over Tasmania recently, and it's unbelievable the amount of just groups. I don't think herd is actually an inaccurate word to use for these groups of Chinese that you see. For example, going all over downtown Christchurch. They've all got their selfie sticks out going through the botanical garden in Christchurch. I mean, and a lot of times, I mean, I've actually had to yell at them to get out of my way because they have a way of, it's like they're oblivious to their physical presence. They're standing there. They block the aisles in the grocery store. They block the sidewalk. They stand there. They're obsessed with taking pictures of each other. They don't pay attention to oncoming traffic. They might be standing on a sidewalk that also happens to be the bicycle lane, which is often the case in Christchurch and other cities. I've had to yell at them to get out of my way. So that I didn't have to swerve on my bicycle just because they aren't watching, paying attention to where they are. And the selfie stick thing, and it's just like I've had them come up and just sort of intrude on where I was standing alone with a beautiful tree in the Christchurch Botanical Garden. They come up and start taking pictures of each other. And it's just, to me, this is a very grave issue. But it's not even that benign. Chinese interests have been systematically taken over the water rights to all kind of places in New Zealand. I won't tell these stories now, but a big thing just happened in Christchurch. It's happened somewhere else. All over Australia, they're buying up all the land, the real estate, whole areas with just Chinese industry, like a whole island in Western Australia. And my friend Ian McAllister in Christchurch, he goes like, well, it is. It's a soft takeover. That was his expression. So, but this relates to the tourism thing because somehow they're getting in way more than people from any other country. And you don't see, I've never, ever, ever in all my years down under, I've never seen a busload of people from India empty itself. I've never seen a busload of people from Africa. I've never seen a busload of any people that was all the exact same, except for busloads of Chinese that I've seen get out. I've seen that at the airport in Sydney. I've seen it in New Zealand. So what's up with this? Why can't they stay there? China's a big place. New Zealand's actually quite small. And I think a lot of them are actually not just tourists. They're here looking to buy stuff. And unfortunately, in New Zealand, just like everywhere else, almost everybody has their price for their farm, their property, their winery, their art gallery, their restaurant. It'll all be sold. And another issue that I've noticed in Auckland, in different parts of Australia, Tasmania, it's possible to go in a shop and the people working there do not speak a word of English. Now, I mean, this is not a complaint. I don't care. But it's quite hard to ask somebody if they know where something is, if they don't speak English. But I've run into this numerous times, and all the stuff I'm saying, it's not just me. I bounce this off a lot of different people, like bus drivers and people that travel and people that interact with the public a lot, and they agree. They verify and agree everything I'm talking about. So now we can talk about the dairy farming industry, which is one of the greatest environmental disasters happening all over both islands of New Zealand, especially the South Island, where they rerouted the water from rivers for irrigation of land to feed the dairy cows, and all deforested a lot of area, all the chemicals that are used and the waste from the animals and stuff, and they've got a predator-free New Zealand 2050 thing. That's another one of these bizarre island mentality ideologies of getting rid of every life form that's not from here. But look, if they had even the slightest amount of common sense or accuracy, they would have to admit that, of course, us, man the wise, Homo sapiens, are the biggest invasive species ever. But we don't count because we're us. We're man the wise, so we're the overlords of creation. So everything else that came here is an invasive species except for us. Oh yeah, but we also don't count our millions of dairy cows because they are generating so much money mainly by creating milk that's turned into powder that's manufactured and shipped to, yes, our good friends in China. Now we can talk about the oil industry, the hydrocarbons, petroleum. In New Zealand's exclusive economic zone, fifth largest in the world, I still don't know how that happened. Because Australia's got the biggest, but it's a big country. In New Zealand's exclusive economic zone, there's more hydrocarbons, that's oil, than in the North Sea or in Texas. So that's a huge amount, and this has traditionally been unexploited. Well, under the Key administration, every oil company on the planet has been invited down here. And it really began, I think Key got in 2008. Well, there's this company called Anadarko Petroleum from Texas, A-N-A-D-A-R-K-O, and they're huge all over the world. But they were intimately involved with what was happening in Christchurch at the time of the earthquake in February 2011, the aftermath of which rearranged the entire governmental, bureaucratic, administrative platform structure of New Zealand in the same way that 9/11 served as a new Pearl Harbor in America. In the wake of that, a lot of companies changed hands. A lot of new things happened. Lockheed, the biggest defense contractor in the world, took over the operation of New Zealand's military. Anadarko had all kinds of exploration and drilling exercises going off the Canterbury Basin at the time the quake happened, and they had been there for years. And there's a lot of evidence that Anadarko had a lot to do with the creation of the Christchurch quake. When I've documented this on earlier radio shows, I was really the first to break this story. But only in the past year, some other people have been picking up on it. But they had been seeking a drilling permit for the Canterbury Basin for years. And 4 hours after the Christchurch quake, it was given to them. And if you look at the board of directors of Anadarko, at the time of the Christchurch quake, there was five people, the five top people, had direct connections to a geophysical warfare technology called HAARP, H-A-A-R-P, the original ionospheric heating installation located in Gakona, Alaska. This is another whole story in itself, but it relates to the mining industry because in the world of today, in the true spirit of fascism, which is a complete merger of state and corporate power, big companies like oil companies like Anadarko are really de facto military organizations. They're really branches of the Pentagon and vice versa. Military organizations might serve as industrial deployment operatives. But there's so much hydrocarbons going on. The biggest area and the most long-standing is in the Taranaki Basin, which is off the southwest coast of the North Island. And this includes, it extends almost down to Farewell Spit here, on just not that far from where I am, and up north, about halfway up the North Island. This is the highest amount of drilling and exploration going on. It also happens to be the main area where the wee little Maui's dolphins live, of which there's only about 30 to 50 individuals of the whole species left, doomed to extinction right before our eyes, mainly because of the hydrocarbon industry. But there's other places where a lot of exploration is happening. The Pegasus Basin off of Christchurch, Canterbury Basin, the Otago Basin, the Ranga Basin. There's six or eight of these major regions all around New Zealand. Even though Jacinda Ardern supposedly has proclaimed that no new permits will be given, that doesn't stop the probably thousands that already have been. So on that note, we may as well jump to number two, extinctions. Because in a land proclaiming itself to be 100% clean and green, the fact that you've got the Maui's dolphin teetering right on the brink of extinction in full view of everybody is just absurd, an absurd psychotic contradiction, proving that 100% clean and green is absolute, pardon my French, fucking bullshit. It's almost like they want the Maui's dolphin out of the way, and the oil industry has a lot to do with it, but there's a couple of other factors too, that there used to be some giant chemical plants at New Plymouth, a dioxin facility, which is a chemical warfare agent similar to Agent Orange. A lot of that has got into the land and the ocean there, which might have destroyed their genome. And the fishing industry here, the deep sea trawlers, and the amount of fishing industry that happens in New Zealand, especially this company called Tally. This Tally dude and his brother live in Machueca. And there, if you can put a name on the extinction of the Maui's dolphins, it would be Tally, maybe along with, you know, Anadarko and some other oil companies and stuff. But we were doing a Maui's Dolphin Awareness Day at Pia 2 or 3 years ago. And just right offshore, far, far, far within the limit they weren't supposed to be, was a trawler just sitting there as if to flaunt the fact that even though they weren't supposed to be there and that they were the biggest threat to the Maui's dolphins, that there was nothing anybody could do to them because they're so incestuously inbred with the whole New Zealand government. So the hydrocarbons and the fishing industry are two of the main contributing factors to all the whale strandings, which to me is actually number one on this list because of my very strong affinity for my friends and my family in the ocean, the whales and dolphins. Aihi papahu tahora paikia kahola naya ginong katsakaha wananga. The ultimate indigenous people and a true extraterrestrial intelligence. New Zealand in recent years has become the absolute worst and most dangerous place for whales and dolphins on the whole planet. We've got many, many, many dozens of different stranding and mortality events per year in different places. And then back when I was in Rarotonga in November, there was this unbelievable series of about six different strandings that happened in about a week's time, of which I did a major amount of activism on that. But all the anomalies of these pointed directly to covert anthropogenic activity, which is probably military in nature. So New Zealand's got a massive amount of this kind of stuff going on. This leads to another major issue, is the covert military presence here, which has to do with Antarctica being America's stepping stone to Antarctica. Antarctica is a very strategic place. It's the site of a lot of military bases, but also the home of some of the greatest deposits of natural resources like minerals on the planet. But the fact that it's beneath a mile or two of ice is just, all it's doing is slowing them down. So regardless of proclamations that Antarctica is a protected area, it's not. Why else would all these people be there? There's also a lot of HAARP-type installations there because you need to be able to inject your microwaves into the ionosphere, and the magnetic fields come down close to the Earth at the North and South Pole. Well, there just happens not to be any land at the North Pole, not in this era. So the South Pole is the prime place for the location of these kind of technologies. That's why Lockheed and Raytheon, both, they're the two top leaders in microwave weapons warfare, undersea and atmospheric. They've got massive presences in Christchurch, in New Zealand, and in Antarctica. New Zealand became, well, its ability to function as the stepping stone to Antarctica was really enhanced by the Christchurch quake. So we reckon that because of, there are still some existing environmental regulations in America that might hinder what they would like to be unfettered deployment of all kinds of military testing and war games and actual warfare activities. So they've been making a big shift to down under, to the waters of Australia and New Zealand, the Tasman Sea, the Great Barrier Reef, all around New Zealand in recent years, the U.S. Navy in particular, because there's such vast areas and so few people that they can get away with a lot of this stuff. And the only way we'd be able to detect it, we can't tell where a nuclear submarine is, but we can see when a bunch of dead dolphins wash up or a bunch of whales and that kind of thing, die-offs and stuff like that. And it's because of the propaganda public relations apparatus, it's all going to be attributed to mystery illness, Morbillo virus, the pilot whales got lost, all this stuff. But a lot of evidence points that it's covert anthropogenic military activity. So New Zealand has an extraordinarily large amount of this now, although it's invisible to most people, as is the military presence everywhere. As my beautiful friends at Stranded No More have pointed out, the whales and dolphins that we see wash up on the shore might represent as little as less than 10% of the total amount that were injured or killed during any specific event or process that happened, because a lot of their bodies just don't make it to shore. So we've just been seeing the tip of the iceberg. But if what we saw this past year in New Zealand was the tip of the iceberg, we'd be talking about many, many, many thousands of whales and dolphins that were killed that we just don't know about. All of this is invisible to the public radar. So I've covered all these issues so far. Other species of life are at risk from extinction. For example, the iconic kiwi bird, which is what gives its New Zealand's mascot, the little flightless bird with the long beak. I've never actually seen one in person, but I have heard them on Stewart Island. They're quite reclusive. But they're now endangered, as is the also equally iconic Kea, that's K-E-A. It's a beautiful, green, robust alpine parrot that lives on the South Island, up high in areas like around, well, you'll see them on the West Coast and at Arthur's Pass. They're very cheeky. They like to come up and they'll steal your car keys or eat the rubber out of the lining of your car windshield. But they're really, really cool birds. The last ones I saw were kind of fat because they were eating people's chips and stuff that they were throwing out. This was at Arthur's Pass. But in a land that's proclaiming itself to be 100% clean and green, New Zealand is surely doing a good job of extincting everything, because this is Maui's Kea and Kiwi are, of course, they're not being deliberately extincted, but it wouldn't matter, because if they were trying to deliberately extinct them, I don't know how much of a better job they could do. Because what they are trying to extinct full on, more murderously, in an environmentally insane way than any other country on this planet. It's like they're waging biological warfare against the proclaimed target enemy is invasive animals like possums, stoats, and weasels, that are little, cute little mammals that are actually, possums are beautiful and protected in Australia. They were brought here against their own little will. They didn't want to come here. We brought them here for whatever reason. Now they're living and doing fine, but everything they do we consider to be evil and destructive. Like the possums are blamed for defoliating all these trees, eating tens of thousands of tons of foliage a year, which I seriously do not think that's possible. I mean, I'm not saying that they do exist. I heard one last night. But there's not millions of them. I mean, I've been all over these forests and woods in a lot of remote areas, especially in fjordland, many, many, many times over the past 18 or 19 years, and I've yet to ever see a tree that was defoliated by a possum. And I've looked. I'm not saying it hasn't happened, but I think it's just astronomically over-exaggerated. And there's people that swear by this, even though they've never seen it in their life. They're taking the word of all the DOC propaganda, of which that's their main specialty, other than actually killing innocent life forms. But their mode of choice of killing things, which I consider to be probably the worst environmental disaster happening all over New Zealand, it's this evil poison called 1080, sodium fluoromonoacetate. Central atom is fluorine, the most reactive of all the elements, and this is another story in itself. I just did radio interviews in the past couple of months with Clyde Graff and Fiona McQueen, are two of the top authorities on the whole 1080 scenario in New Zealand. 1080 is a metabolic poison that it kills any animal, invertebrates, insects, arachnids, crustaceans, fish, birds, mammals, reptiles, amphibians, humans, dairy cows, dogs, cats, rodents, everything, anything that uses the Krebs cycle, it kills, because it disrupts the Krebs cycle. The Krebs cycle is what our mitochondria use to make energy, and this is central to all life forms. Mitochondria are little subcellular structures that many people believe used to be free swimming in the ocean, and possibly that their colonization billions of years ago allowed the evolution of multicellular life forms. Well, the mitochondria create the energy for every one cell. They take this stuff called ATP, adenosine triphosphate, and convert it into glucose, the most elementary form of sugar. But that's where all our energy comes from, for our muscles and all the stuff we do. So the 1080 disrupt the Krebs cycle is this process by how the mitochondria make energy. 1080 disrupts this, and it doesn't kill something instantly. It kills an animal over like about 18 hours of just tortuous convulsions and suffering. The reason it's been banned in the USA since 1972 and almost every other country in the world is because of its threat to human health. Well, DOC has been deploying it all over New Zealand systematically, like about, actually, there's probably been 9 different drops in the area right where I'm sitting right now. That's what a girl who lives here told me, called the Kahurangi National Park, where it's estimated that about probably 250,000 kilograms of 1080 have been deployed in New Zealand since the late 1950s. And I can't go into much more detail about that, except that this is, it's toxifying every place in New Zealand, the water, the soil, a lot of it runs out into the ocean. And this is only one of thousands of pesticides used, but it's the most blatant and the most horrific. This is why New Zealand has the highest pesticide use per capita in the world. And it's not unrelated that New Zealand has the or one of the highest rates of per capita cancer, different kinds of cancer in the world. These two factors are not unrelated. So the 1080, the central atom is fluorine. Well, you've heard of water fluoridation and how it's not really about preventing cavities, but if it was, New Zealand's biosphere is going to have really good teeth. But that's not what it's about. Fluorine is a neurotoxin in itself, and almost all of its compounds, it does occur naturally bound up with some minerals, and it does occur in small amounts in your body bound up with the proper minerals, but elemental fluorine, and in the form as dispersed in 1080, it can't just magically break down into salt and vinegar or disappear into the environment. Even if it breaks down into its constituent elements, which is the simplest components that any compound can break down into, short of being in a cyclotron or atom smasher or a supernova explosion, you're going to have, for every kilogram of 1080 that's deployed, a fourth of that, about 250 grams, is going to be fluorine. Where's it going to go? Well, everywhere, but fluorine especially binds with calcium, which means it's going to go into the bones of any being with bones. That's a logical first place to look, but in other words, the long and the short of it is the astronomical use of 1080 all over New Zealand is in effect fluoridating the New Zealand biosphere. And I believe that there's powers that be, possibly not in New Zealand, but at a supranational level of the UN or some kind of these nefarious three-letter acronym organizations, mainly that we don't even know about. They know that this is going on, and what it's all about, it's about dumbing down and eventually getting rid of most of the people of New Zealand, the sheeple, if you want to call them that. Now, I love New Zealand. I've got a lot of good friends here, but the island mentality is just rampant. You know, the people that think this is 100% clean and green, they don't actually, like, anything that I just said on this whole show is going to be called conspiracy theory. Or like my friend, well, I won't really call him my friend anymore, Tim Lynch, who does Green Planet FM in Auckland. He interviewed me because of my knowledge about the whales and dolphins and the threats to them 2 or 3 years ago. But since then, he's completely blown me off when I wanted to talk about the danger of Operation Mahi-Tangaroa when the U.S. warships all came to Auckland Harbor. And right on the very day that started was the 7.8 quake in Kaikoura. These events were not unrelated. So he wouldn't even admit that geophysical warfare existed. But in the past year or two, he started talking about it a little bit, but not with me. He won't talk with me, but he's got to talk about these other people that are just now getting on the bandwagon of awareness. So my friend yesterday, she said, well, Jeff, if climate change isn't the major environmental catastrophe that it's being made out to be, what do we need to be aware of? And again, this is something that I walk around thinking about all the time and have talked about for many, many years and written about. And I think it's important to be aware of the significance of non-human life, Mother Earth and our family of plants and animals. They're just as important as we are in the eyes of Mother Earth. We're all her children. We're the only one that's gone off the rail and it's become a threat to everybody else. We also need to be aware of the invisibility of our war on life, because a lot of it is just the side effect of our day-to-day routine. Driving cars, building houses, disposing of plastic, using microwave transmitters, all the stuff. The invisibility of our war on life. And a lot of that's military. Like, we've been conditioned to, even when we see military stuff, we don't see it. Because it's there to protect us against the evil enemy, the evil Russians, the evil Chinese. That's why I wrote the satire about Elon Musk using the military to wage war on climate change. Because it's clearly made out to be the biggest enemy we've ever had. So why not wage war on it using the military? But the military itself is a weapon. It's the most destructive entity on the planet, and the hugest, just by its very existence. Even if it's not turned on, even if it's not rolling on its tracks and armor to wage war, or launching missiles and submarines and atom bombs and all that stuff, bullets, even if it's not doing all that, just the fact that it exists is still waging war on Mother Earth. And my beautiful friend, who I wish I could have met, Dr. Rosalie Bertel, wrote extensively about this. We need to be aware of the true dangers of life to life from what we're doing. The toxicity, chemical and radiological, which, unlike carbon dioxide, unlike climate change in any of its manifestations, even if it was real, or including real climate change, it's not going to give you cancer. It's not going to destroy your genome. It's not going to make your grandkids have three heads. It's not going to help create mutations in a developing embryo. That's what toxicity can do, chemical and radiological. The electromagnetic scenario with the ubiquity of microwaves, our phones, the transmitters, the ionospheric heaters, your microwave oven, your routers, all this different kind of stuff, we're saturated with microwaves, which are a form of carcinogen. Look at what the Russian scientists have known since the 1930s. They said they know that at a level 1,000 times lower than the level at which heating occurs, 1,000 times lower than that, negative biological consequences begin to happen. We need to be aware of the agendas of fellow groups of people who have proclaimed themselves to be the overlords of the planet. But ultimately, we need to bring our own lives in tune with the highest knowledge we have. We're not going to prevent what I believe to be the inevitable fulfillment of the Hopi prophecy called the Day of Purification, a time when Mother Earth and the Great Spirit cleanse the earth of everything that's out of balance using all kinds of natural forces like fire, wind, flood. I believe the next one's going to happen from a cometary impact, which I believe that dolphins actually warned me about this 2 or 3 years ago. Thomas Bunyakya, the Hopi elder I met in 1986 at Big Mountain, standing on the land where some of the uranium for the first atomic bomb was mined, he said, "The Hopi prophecy is if we dig precious things from the land, we will invite disaster. Look at what we've done with all the stuff we've dug from the land and continue to do so, especially here in New Zealand, Australia. We cannot hope to avert the Day of Purification, but what we can hope to do through all our good actions is to lessen its severity." To me, these words have echoed in my mind, that to lessen the severity of the purification means that whatever Mother Earth has to do to get rid of us, which is going to be a lot, it's going to take out a lot or the majority of every other life form on the planet who are already suffering because of us. So every good thing we can do now, everything we can cut back on, every way we can simplify our lives, lessen our ecological impact, our footprint, live simply so that others may simply live, do without stuff that we need in order to, in honor of our love of our fellow beings and Mother Earth. Stop eating meat. Be vegan. All these things, it all matters. Just because a comet's going to come and take us all out doesn't mean we should give up and just party till doomsday. We should do our best because we might have a chance to be the people of one heart of all the species of life who are going to be the seeds of the new creation, and all the beautiful wisdom and knowledge that we can store within ourselves will be memories that the seeds might have to help them remember how to not do this yet again. This is Jeff Phillips Weverson here sitting by the Anatoki River. I love you all. Here's a big hug. Keep it in the road and live simply so that others may simply live.
Good day.